Coming up next on Tech News Weekly, from Sonic Booms to Sonic Thuds. Also, Amazon's bumpy road to HQ2. The new Anki Vector robot is adorable and kind of noisy. And a new Raspberry Pi 3A Plus is announced. All that and more coming up next on Tech News Weekly.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Tech News Weekly, episode 58, recorded Thursday, November 15th, 2018. This episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by LastPass. Secure every password-protected entry point to your business. Join over 43,000 businesses and start managing and securing your company's passwords today. Learn more at lastpass.com/twit.
And by DigitalOcean, the easiest cloud platform to deploy, manage, and scale applications. Over 150,000 businesses rely on DigitalOcean to remove infrastructure friction and deliver industry-leading price performance. Sign up today and receive a free $100 credit at do.co/twit.
And by privacy.com. Stop using the same card number everywhere. Use privacy virtual cards and get a $5 credit off your first purchase. Learn more and sign up in under a minute with your debit or checking account at privacy.com/TNW.
Welcome to Tech News Weekly. This is the show we talk to and about the breaking news of the week. We talk to the breaking news of the week.
Sometimes, when yes. We're lucky.
Yes. So let's get right to our first story. Now, in 1973, the FAA banned passenger airlines from supersonic flights over the U.S. And as Dan Vergano writes in BuzzFeed, it was seen as an early win for environmental groups. But now, Sonic Boom testing is starting again in Galveston, Texas, and Dan is here to talk to us about it. Thanks for coming on the show, Dan.
Good to be here. Good to talk to you.
So the tests in the 60s were in Oklahoma City, and they did not go so well. Talk a little bit about those tests.
They were incredible. You couldn't do them now. They did something like 1,500 sonic booms 8 times a day for 6 months over Oklahoma City, and they ramped up the intensity over this time to see how people would like it. They figured, you know, people would adjust. And it turned out that they pissed people off. There were death threats. About a third of the population wanted to move. People wanted to complain to the Chamber of Commerce, to FAA and everybody else. FAA concluded from this that, you know, people probably could live with the early ones, which are quiet. Nobody else thought that. The National Academy of Sciences said it's a bad idea, and the whole thing birthed a environmental movement opposed to noise pollution centered around airplane noises.
So why are they doing it again now? What's different now?
Right. So now we have better technology.
of course. We have
invented low boom aircraft. It's actually incredible work that NASA has done. Very careful, smart shaping of the sonic boom waveform that's spread it out into a thud. You still get the same energy of the boom, but they've gotten longer planes with different doodads on them that lift and extend the boom, so that it becomes more of a thud. And so they think that maybe if the sonic boom is the problem, then we can have supersonic flight, which would be nice, faster flight all over the country. And instead of like a cannon going off in your ear all at once, it's the sound of a car door shutting overhead and won't annoy people so much. It might be a problem, though, for other reasons. But the Galveston tests, which are starting this month, are basically a month-long effort to simulate this low boom noise and see how the people in that community react.
So I imagine with the low boom technology, if low boom technology is what this is a matter of aerodynamics design of the plane. Are the planes going any slower than what would have been like achieving a sonic boom prior?
It's the same deal. They go faster than the speed of sound. This one's designed to go Mach 1.4, which at the altitude they're going at is about 55,000 feet. It's about 950 miles an hour, which is, you know, a third faster than current jetliners. And the trick is that the thing is shaped like a pencil. So instead of a compact jet where all the shock waves that are coming off the leading edges coalesce when they hit the ground, with the longer shape, they don't get a chance to coalesce. And they've also added cantilevered wings to the front. that shape that boom a little bit to stretch it out, and thump bumps on the back. And there's a cool set of second ailerons on the back tail that they sort of alter to shape the, to change the shape of the boom as the shocks are going in there. So it's all kinds of very complicated computational fluid dynamics that you have to do to get this to work. But it does seem like it they're very confident it would work, at least in the modeling, and they can get F-18s to do a dive that simulates what the thump would sound like. They claim it can be less than 75 decibels. This is a loud conversation in a restaurant compared to a chainsaw going off in your ear like a regular sonic boom. And so we'll see. But the real question, it turns out, isn't so much the technology. At least that's what we found when we talked to NASA, which was so interesting. They said, well, the plane is hard, but the real thing is people. Like, will people accept this? It's a little bit analogous to the driverless cars question. Will people accept a car in the street that doesn't have a driver behind the wheel? Will people accept the sound of this thud, even if it is quieter than a real sonic boom?
Yeah, this is. I mean, so it's not heard inside the plane. If you're flying it, you don't hear it. So, and
you're going faster than it. You outrun it.
Right. So, I mean, it's kind of a like not over my backyard situation because
it's an NIMBY deal. Yeah.
Yeah. So, why Galveston? I mean, do they know? I've spent some time in Galveston. I grew up in Houston. That was where we would vacation. Do they know they're going to have these quieter than they used to be sonic booms, but still maybe noise pollution?
That's the trick. The answer is that Galveston's on the coast, and so you can dive the plane off in from the ocean, and the ocean gets the boom. There's a nice map, and the city gets the thud. Mm. So it's a great place to do this kind of test with an F-18 to simulate what the thud noises are. So really, the test isn't can we do the thud. The response is what is the community's response to it. Mm-hmm. That's why you do it in Galveston. Also, it's a small city, so you can constrain the responses you get, to do it over a giant city would be a problem. But people in Galveston are being told about this, and they said they're probably going to overdo it a little bit in terms of how much warning they give them, because they don't want people to feel like, what the, totally like guinea pigs. But there's a question, like, if you warn people too much, then every time a trash can falls off a truck, everybody calls in to NASA, right? And if you do it too little, then everybody gets mad when they find out about it. So there's this balance that they're trying to go for, and they're trying to figure out what is the appropriate amount of warning to give a community, because they're hoping in 2023 to test this over major cities with the X-59 that's going to be built next year. And they don't want to do that wrong, because that'll be the real noise test of this thing.
So obviously it's sonic boom, sonic thud, they're noise pollution at yep. on one level. But is any of this unhealthy? Like, is it bad for people's health? Are they concerned from that level as well?
The sound, the decibel levels from the thud shouldn't be bad for people's health. There have been past studies suggesting, like, well, if you surprise people, they might have a heart attack, they might fall off ladders, things like this. But just in terms of raw sound, no. The problem is the psychology. Again, if you drive people crazy doing it and they want to move and you depress the value of their house because it's in the flight path of one of these things, then that's not good for people. So it's more of a community response thing, a human psychology question in terms of harms, than a raw, like, punch you in the ear kind of with a sound problem.
And is the plane itself better for the environment, or is it worse for the environment? Are supersonic jets better or worse?
It's obviously worse. Mm-hmm. It costs, it takes more fuel to go faster. That's just how it is. They can make low emissions engines compared to the past, compared to the Concorde, which is a very high emissions aircraft. The Concorde, I'm sure your viewers are familiar with, was the English and French plane that flew across the ocean until 2003. But you still got to burn more fuel to do this. And so the question is, like, okay, they're more efficient than they used to be, but they're still burning more fuel so some plutocrats can go from Los Angeles to New York faster. Is that a great thing for our environment, especially after 2023, 10 years from now, even before they really get these things ginned up? Are people then going to be so happy with, a source of pollution?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you pointed out in your article, thought it was kind of interesting, the kind of layers of complication around, the environmental factors here is that on one hand, yes, it might actually not be very good for the environment, but at the same time, if you've got just these, this small amount of people flying these instead of, on the larger planes, impacting that so much more, then it might actually be okay for the environment.
Right.
So who knows?
Yeah, if it's just a couple of plutocrats, then it's not so much. But if everybody's on one the size of a 747, then yeah, that's a lot of emissions.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
you know, what's the right answer there? And it's also important to point out that, you know, there is a story that the Concorde was killed by the boom it made. And, you know, this question of emissions and costs, you know, is if fuel is, you know, running really expensive a gallon, is this thing going to work economically? Sure. Those are the kind of like hard questions that really determine the future of like aircraft success or not, mm-hmm. at least passenger aircraft.
Yeah.
Well, Dan, thank you so much for joining us. Dan Vergano is a science reporter for BuzzFeed News based in Washington, D.C. Thanks for taking the time. And you can check out his article at BuzzFeed. Thanks so much.
You bet. Thanks very much.
All right. Coming up after the break, Amazon's Road to HQ2. We'll talk with Ben Fox Rubin from CNN about that. But first, this episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by LastPass. What is your company doing to ensure passwords are being shared appropriately? Well, LastPass Enterprise makes password sharing convenient for employees while keeping access to corporate data secure. It even allows for full customization of access, including the ability to set master password requirements, enable password resets, and restrict access when needed. You can configure over 100 policies, access security reports, and create shared folders. Organize database logins, SSH keys, software licenses, and business information as well. And you can further protect your business with multi-factor authentication. It's baked right into there, into the LastPass product. With the LastPass Authenticator app, a verification button actually pops up on an employee's phone to guarantee they are the only ones with access to their accounts. If the credentials are compromised, the app ensures outsiders will not have access. And I love this feature. The LastPass password generator actually makes it super easy to use unique random passwords that employees don't have to remember to write down. It creates them for you based on the rules that you set, and just makes your password so much more secure that way. Employees can log into LastPass with their Microsoft Active Directory credentials, so they truly only have one password to remember. And data is, of course, encrypted and decrypted at the device level. Data stored in the vault is kept secret, even from LastPass. From easy onboarding to password autofill, LastPass makes it easy for businesses to take control of passwords and reduce the threat of breach. And the iOS 12 and Android Pie autofill functionality makes it even easier for employees to seamlessly use LastPass across mobile devices. When you open an app or you visit a mobile site, the keyboard itself is going to offer up your username or your password as an autofill option, similar to what AutoCorrect looks like now. So you don't have to copy and paste from your LastPass app. It's all done seamlessly. LastPass also offers LastPass Premium for personal use, LastPass Families for your entire family, and LastPass Teams for teams of 50 or fewer. So I recommend that you use LastPass. I use it. I love it. We use it here at Twit every single day, and it protects us, and we feel more secure just using the product. LastPass is awesome. More than 16 million people trust LastPass, the number one most preferred password manager, and you can learn more at lastpass.com/twit today. That's lastpass.com/twit, and see which product is right for you. So once upon a time, basically a year or so, a small company called Amazon, actually one of the largest companies in the world, began its Cinderella story, hoping to find a knight in shining armor that would house its second headquarters in the U.S. It wanted one lucky metropolitan area to woo it, to sweep it off its feet, to offer it diamonds and pearls and, let's be real, tax benefits that would allow the company to continue its pursuit of world domination by the way of Prime memberships and lightning deals that we're all going to enjoy this holiday season. Then the company abruptly announced not one, not two, but three winning cities, two sort of winners and one consolation prize to the third, and people are not happy. Joining us to spell out the timeline and what this means for Amazon and for the cities it chose is Ben Fox Rubin from CNET. Welcome back to the show, Ben.
Thanks very much for having me.
You bet. It's great to have you on today, and we really appreciate it. So Amazon had cities across the U.S. literally crawling over themselves to be selected for HQ2. Many of the concessions were humiliating. Some were egregious. How could one company hold so much power and influence over these U.S. cities? It's kind of crazy when you think about it.
Yeah, absolutely. And it captivated a lot of the attention of just the broader general public. And the main reason for that is because this was really the big one. There has not been, for instance, in New York State, ever in its history a job creation project of this size. And that's considering the fact that New York State ended up getting half the original project at 25,000 employees. So it's kind of hard to really wrap your head around how big this project actually is, but 25,000 employees in each location, these are enormous undertakings, and that's why these communities, these public leaders, were so willing to bend over backwards in the interest of getting this huge project.
So they were all sold on this idea of getting the whole package. And then, you know, somewhere along the line, Amazon decided and kind of kept it a secret that it was going to split things between them. Would the cities have been as involved as they were if they knew that from the onset? How would that change kind of the calculus behind this?
I think ultimately they probably would have offered less money up front. We're seeing some of these packages now coming out, and some of them are really eye-popping. For instance, the city of Philadelphia, where I'm from, offered something to the tune of $5.7 billion. Pittsburgh offered something fairly similar. We already knew about Newark offering $7 billion. Montgomery County, Maryland, offering $8.5 billion. These are huge, huge numbers, especially considering that the project was going to cost Amazon $5 billion. So some of those are well above. So those numbers would have been lower. I think primarily what would have changed significantly would have been the media attention. These numbers were so big, and it was labeled this thing called HQ2, and it really fascinated a lot of the national and international media. And if this was really being positioned as two very large regional offices, but Seattle was still going to remain the headquarters, I can't imagine that it would have received the enormous level of attention that it did over the past year.
So we've heard about the jobs that, you know, 25,000 jobs for each of these communities. What are some of the negatives that these places can expect having a headquarters there or a non-headquarters there?
Some of them include higher rents, increased traffic, strain on infrastructure, strain on schools. These are some of the issues that Seattle has already dealt with. It's what has been charmingly called in Seattle the prosperity bomb, where you do get a lot of really good, high-paying jobs. You also get a lot of indirect jobs and a lot of indirect business that gets developed because Amazon has come to town, or any major tech company for that matter. But at the same time, it is an enormous strain on a lot of other resources. And that's why I think a lot of folks have been very annoyed at the incentives that were given to Amazon, because it's going to cost these communities a lot of money to actually house and be able to support Amazon coming in with this many employees.
Yeah, not only that, there was the Wall Street Journal report that was an interesting read on kind of like the details, the timeline of all this stuff. Amazon was telling local officials that they'd be visiting an area a matter of days later. And I mean, it really seemed like Amazon knew, you know, it walked in there with a stride and it was like, yeah, we know you want us. So, you know, be ready in 5 days when we're there. What was Amazon? What do you think Amazon was hoping to gain out of kind of this strategy, just to up the ante and make everybody completely make fools of themselves?
It does appear from that story, it does appear like they were trying to make people jump through a lot of different hoops. I would like to think that Amazon was trying to do some level of due diligence,
sure,
to find out what they were trying to, where the best locations were potentially. But at the same time, local officials were really forced, it seems, into a lot of difficult positions in hopes of snagging this project. And obviously, as we saw, there really weren't that many winners. So a lot of local officials spent a lot of time, a lot of money. Some of them hired consultants for a lot of money, as the Wall Street Journal story mentioned. And they ended up with nothing. They didn't end up winning much. Some of the statements that I heard from some of these locations were they tried to put the best face on it, where they said, we're really proud of us putting our best foot forward. We're proud of the exposure that we got. But ultimately, it was a lot of time and money spent on this one project.
Mm-hmm. And so what about the lack of enough employees? I mean, that's why they said they had to divide it into two cities. I mean, was that like that? That's a problem everywhere, sort of just like this, you know, this trained employees. But what do you make of that being the reason that they had to split it into two places?
I think it makes a lot of sense. I think in retrospect, the idea of locating 50,000 employees in one city all in one shot in a fairly short time span, it seems a little ridiculous. It seems kind of wild. So I think ultimately they came to the very realistic realization that 25,000 for these two locations is still a ton, but much more realistic and something that they'll be able to bite off in a much more reasonable amount of time. I mean, both of these locations are expected to build out and locate all of these employees in a matter of a decade. These are still huge, huge projects. So considering being able to do that for one location just seems pretty wild. One other thing to mention about that is that Seattle has 45,000 employees, and it took Amazon 20 years to build out to 45,000.
Kidding. Right. So then what are these communities that are, you know, that have been chosen feeling about this? Like on one hand, yay, job infusion. On the other hand, all the other kind of headaches and potential, you know, downsides that come along with it. Are the communities that have been chosen, are they happy?
What I found really interesting about this is that it seemed to have bisected completely. Virginia seems to be completely fine with this whole situation. All their politicians have either provided very supportive statements about HQ2 or have largely remained silent. In New York, they're having like a small rebellion on their hands where Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and a bunch of other local officials have been protesting against this. There was actually a protest where reported about 100 people were protesting against this plan actually coming in. So it looks like Amazon needs to try to smooth things over a little bit more in New York to actually get squared away there.
Well, you live in Brooklyn, a neighbor of Queens. Like, are your the people around you, have you heard people that aren't in tech or, you know, that I don't know if you hang out with people who aren't in tech. I certainly don't. But are there people that are concerned with this at all?
I actually live in the suburbs of New Jersey.
Oh, so I'm sorry. I don't. Okay, sorry. You just look like you're from Brooklyn. I'm sorry.
Thank you. Thank you so much. That's the nicest thing
I meant it as a compliment.
I obviously plan on, you know, going down and getting a chance to talk to people. I would think, having been a local news reporter, I would expect being on the ground, you will hear a variety of opinions. So some local politicians have obviously been very loud and very vocal in their opposition to this plan. I would very strongly anticipate there are other locals that are very excited about this plan, that are very interested in the job prospects, that are very interested in the indirect jobs that are created. The other important thing to note about this is that we're talking about New York City. This is a very dense population to begin with. It's not like they're plunking down 25,000 employees in Sheboygan and completely changing around the entire community. So from a neighborhood perspective, from an infrastructure perspective, obviously there are going to be a lot of changes, but I think Amazon at least correctly decided to locate in places that were already densely populated that would be able to sustain such large regional offices.
Well, when you look at the list of the chosen few that were selected to move on to the next round to try and get the rose, a lot of those fit this mold, this particular mold that they ended up choosing. But some of those, it would have completely changed things, which makes you wonder, like, did Amazon ever like consider that much more than just like paying it lip service and let's see what they can come up with? What I found interesting is that there were regions that did move on to the next round that offered way more in the way of incentives, economic incentives particularly, yet they weren't chosen. It's not that Amazon was hurting as far as these incentives were concerned with the ones that they did select, but what does that say about Amazon's ambitions then?
I think location ended up mattering a lot more than I think people realized. Yeah. Like I said before, Montgomery County, Maryland is actually located pretty close to Crystal City in Virginia, which ended up winning out. And Montgomery County offered billions and billions of dollars more in funding. So location obviously mattered. Talent obviously mattered. And those are two really important aspects. Going back to something else that you said, as far as locating folks and really potentially changing something and creating an enormous economic development potential, it is for me personally, I think it is a little unfortunate that Amazon didn't decide to go in that direction. One can only imagine what could have happened in a place like Newark, New Jersey, or Indianapolis if these huge regional offices were to be located there. They would have had a huge impact. But at the same time, I also understand that Amazon isn't the company that it used to be when it first located in Seattle and wants to hire a lot of people and move very quickly, and isn't as interested in kind of redeveloping an entire community for their offices.
It does seem that they aren't very concerned with the PR optics of all of this. I mean, like you said, there are definitely communities that could have really taken advantage of this. And then, you know, you look at a place like Dallas, a metropolitan city that, you know, that missed out. And, you know, it's very far from D.C., where I think Amazon probably hopes to be close to regulators and politicians and lobbyists and things like that. I mean, it doesn't look that great for them. It doesn't seem like they really cared.
They are absolutely interested in the PR about this. And if you're curious to kind of see why, there have been hints basically all year where Jeff Bezos offered $2 billion for a new foundation. Amazon also said that they were going to increase their minimum wage to $15 an hour. They're trying to do a lot more to try to curry favor with the public. They obviously understand that a lot of people look at them negatively more so than they used to because the company is growing so quickly. There are a lot of concerns about it becoming a monopoly in the future. And they are trying to get ahead of that by also advertising a lot about how they're helping small businesses. So I think they're very aware of the negative responses, and I wouldn't be surprised if they're trying to do something about it behind the scenes.
Mm-hmm. Well, that makes sense. Yeah, I guess they do care.
Amazon.
They care about looking good.
Yeah, they care. They care absolutely about looking good.
That's the important part. Yeah.
Right. Yes,
right. Well, I guess we'll see if the multiple HQ headquarters strategy actually works in the long run. We've got a long ways to wait before we'll ever get that answer. But I'm sure we'll continue to hear more from people who are not very happy about this, lawmakers included. Ben Fox Rubin from CNET, really appreciate your time tonight talking about this. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Absolutely. And everybody should check out his work on CNET.com. All right. Up next, we get an in-studio visit by a real robot. And at least I will hope that it doesn't eliminate us from existence. But before that, we have to thank the sponsor of this episode, and that is DigitalOcean. DigitalOcean is the easiest cloud platform to deploy, manage, and scale applications of any size. DigitalOcean actually offers an intuitive control panel and an API designed for developers. As a developer, I assume you want to spend more time coding and less time managing your infrastructure. I would imagine so anyways. Well, DigitalOcean lets you do just that. You can choose from standard or CPU-optimized droplets and customize from there. And how about this? You can save up to 55% compared to other cloud providers. Plus, simple, predictable pricing. DigitalOcean has always been on mission to simplify the complexities of infrastructure, and that includes pricing. They believe pricing should be straightforward and predictable. No confusing surprises, no weird extra costs at the end of the month when you receive your bill. It's just that simple. Here's what else you get at no additional cost. 99.99% uptime SLA, cloud firewalls, monitoring and alerting, full DNS management, global data centers, enterprise-class SSDs, an easy-to-use API. Over 150,000 businesses, including early-stage startups, rely on DigitalOcean to remove infrastructure friction and deliver industry-leading price performance. So sign up today and receive a free $100 credit at do.co/twit. That's do.co/twit for a free $100 credit. And we thank DigitalOcean for their support of Tech News Weekly.
Is there a helper robot on your holiday wish list this year? If there isn't, why not? And if there is, might I recommend the Anki Vector robot? The third version of this tiny lifelike robot that can do your bidding.
Oh, that there he so is. So cool looking.
So you just talk to him. Hey, Vector. Give me a fist bump.
Oh.
Is it-
It knew, and it knew where the sound, where your voice came from behind it.
Yes. It's,
it doesn't know that there's a microphone there, but that's okay.
I have had all three versions of this little guy who I'm going to pick up now and show you. And this is the third one. He's $250. I should say that right up front. You have to really love robots or have a kid that really loves robots. But you can ask him all kinds of things and he gets angry.
Wow. Yeah. No kidding.
Because I picked him up. So I could say, hey, Vector, what's the weather?
65 degrees and sunny.
Oh.
And if you're just listening, he just showed a little sun. And I can ask him, hey, Vector, what's the weather in New York City?
30 degrees and snowing.
I like our weather better. Although I like that animation better.
I so, do too.
You know, it's hard to know which direction to go. Hey, Vector, take a picture. Oh, it's getting ready. Nice. Now, where does that show up?
So that shows up on the app. So let me see where it shows up. Things to try.
It almost jumped for it.
Where are the... Ask it to play a game.
Hey, I'll Vector. Look for the photos. Play games. What are we... Oh, whoa. It's doing like a card game.
Blackjack.
Oh, blackjack. Okay.
You have 18.
Hold. Is that what I do?
Or... Another card?
No. Definitely not. Not with 18. Okay.
Taylor's turn.
Oh. 18. Oh, okay. Well, neither of us lost. Thank you, Vector.
Play another round.
No, I'm horrible at gambling. But thank you, Vector.
Ask it if it knows your name.
Hey, Vector, do you know my name? I guess he doesn't know my name. He or she doesn't know my name.
Not yet. Well, try telling him your name.
Oh, hey, Vector.
My name is Jason. Yes? Okay, he's scanning me. Uh-huh. Yeah, I'm feeling stared at right now.
Jason.
Yes.
Jason.
That's my name. Don't wear it out. Don't fall.
It has edge detection, as you can see.
Okay, good.
Yeah, it's not going to fall. So here's the photo that it took. Not the best, but we do have a lot of lights.
Yes, we have a lot of lights in the backdrop. But still cool.
Yeah, you can also...
Yes. Hi.
You can ask it to set a timer.
Hey, Vector. Set a timer for 5 seconds. His face turned into, I don't know if it's he or she, by the way. But.
And then you pet it to make it stop. Yeah.
Okay. It's okay. It's okay. Calm down.
And you can say good robot.
Good robot. Does it not?
I think you might have to say, hey, Vector, good robot.
Hey. That's one of the challenges with this kind of technology, because on one hand, we want it to be conversational. On the other hand, we don't want it always listening.
Right. Exactly.
So, yeah. Hey, Vector. Good robot. Oh. Alrighty then. And then when Vector gets low on batteries, it'll go home automatically, right?
Or you can tell it to go home.
Hey, Vector. Look at me. Go home, please. Kind of looked a little disappointed that I sent him home.
Probably it did. It will eventually find its home, I think. It should.
We'll hope so. Otherwise, it's going to be trapped out in the wilderness with no more battery once the battery runs out.
You could also say, hey, Vector, go to sleep.
Okay, so I will admit that Vector is adorable when you're interacting with Vector. However, I will also admit that Vector was asleep in the office while I was working the past couple of days. And by asleep, I mean not really. Because every once in a while, he'd just go, which is really great when you're actually talking to Vector, but really annoying when you're not.
Woke back up. See, like you put him to sleep, and he was like a baby, kind of.
It knows. Or it knows Tamagotchi. I'm yelling right now, and I'm sorry, Vector. I'm sorry I woke you up, but.
Hey, Vector.
Kind of looks sad.
Hey, Vector. Hey, Vector. Hey, Vector.
Hey, Vector. We're done with you.
I can also change the color of its eyes.
Oh, that's amazing. That's what I was waiting for.
So I can make them orange.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Yellow.
All right.
Green. Blue.
So, okay. So what does the third generation Vector do that the first generation?
Answers questions. Hey, Vector. I have a question. Who is Leo Laporte?
Leo Gordon Laporte is an American technology broadcaster, author, entrepreneur, and head of Twit.tv.
And it's going to get Alexa support in December. So you will be able to ask it all the questions that you ask your Amazon Echo. That's coming soon, before the holidays.
Could you imagine Vector traveling freely around the bottom floor of your home as like just a roaming robot that you never get tired of?
I can. I have tried that. The dog does not attack him, which is good. We've taught our other Vector how to deliver the dog treats, so I think that's probably why the dog likes Vector. I wish that it would vacuum.
Yeah.
Like, if this were combined with a vacuum, that would be amazing.
It would take a long time. Oh, actually, if it could, like, board the vacuum.
Yes. Yeah, take a ride on the vacuum.
Yeah, it'd be like, it's time to vacuum.
Yeah.
Get on top of the Roomba, and then it's like the Roomba is its vehicle. Mm-hmm. That would be pretty awesome.
Yeah.
Fourth generation. They're
right,
working on
exactly.
That.
So cool. I like what they're doing. I like Anki as a company. They've made different stuff every year that I've always found to be delightful. And so this one is just a little more advanced. I wouldn't necessarily say, you know, it's something that's 100% useful. I just think it's fun to have around.
Mm-hmm.
And it's friendly and cute. And maybe that, you know, means it's going to eventually take over and eliminate the world.
I'm pretty sure this tiny little robot is not going to take over the world. All I have to do is lift it up like this and never mind. I concede. I concede, robot.
The Anki robot, it's $250. You can get it wherever robots are sold. You can watch more of their funny videos or check out more information about it at Anki.com. If the Anki robot did not wow you, if $250 is not in your price range for this holiday season, what about $10? Jason's got some tech that just was announced today. But first, I want to thank Privacy.com, the sponsor of this show. You don't use the same password everywhere, so why use the same card number when you shop online? Privacy.com generates a brand new virtual Visa card number for every purchase you make online with just one click. It's easy. Simply download their browser extension from the Chrome Web Store or their Android or iOS app and link your virtual cards to your U.S. checking account or your debit card. You can freeze and unfreeze cards, and you can set spending limits per charge, per month, or per year. With Privacy.com, never worry about being billed twice or getting upgraded without your consent. And there's no need to worry about forgetting to cancel subscriptions or free trials. You can never have to worry about that again. Refunds work even if the card is closed or paused. And you can earn up to 5% cash back. Virtual cards are locked to a merchant, so you don't have to worry about changing your card everywhere if one gets hacked. You'll get a decline email or a push notification if a hacker tries to use the card somewhere else. You can even figure out when merchants likely got hacked, often before those merchants even know themselves. The security of your data is at the core of what Privacy.com does. They're PCI DSS compliant, and they're held to the same security standards as your bank. Sensitive information is secured using military-grade encryption. Information is encrypted using split-key encryption with partial keys held by separate employees. No single person can access the sensitive data on the server because it requires multiple keys to decrypt, like the nuclear launch code in war games. And true to their name, these cards let you use any billing info you like, so your information remains secure and private. Privacy.com believes customers should have full control of their data, so they provide their customers access to transaction data via a webhook API and they support two-factor authentication. Privacy.com is 100% free to use, just like credit cards. They make money from merchants, so they will not sell your information, and there are no hidden fees. Privacy.com has saved customers over $100 million in unwanted and unauthorized charges due to compromised cards, hidden fees, and those pesky forgotten subscriptions. Protect your privacy and your money with virtual cards from privacy.com. To learn more and get a $5 credit off your first purchase, visit privacy.com/TNW. That's privacy.com/TNW. And we thank privacy.com for their support of this show.
So everyone's been waiting for a new Raspberry Pi 3 upgrade. I know I've been waiting for the Raspberry Pi 3 upgrade. And today is your lucky day, sort of. If you were waiting for the Pi 3 B Plus to get its long-awaited upgrade, you're not going to get that. I'm sorry. I kind of built you up and then tore you down. But if you, like many out there, enjoyed having an A Plus form factor version of the Raspberry Pi 1 back in 2014, then you're going to be happy to hear that they are actually bringing it back with the newly announced Raspberry Pi 3 Model A Plus. This actually brings most of the 3 B Plus's biggest features to a smaller form factor, which also means it's less expensive for one. Also, it has the same processor, same memory, dual bands, 802.11ac wireless and Bluetooth 4.2 and more. And it all fits on a board the size of a hat, not this hat that you wear on the top of your head. That stands for hardware attached on top. In so doing, it eliminates the USB hub from the B Plus, replacing it with a single USB port. So it shrinks things down a little bit. It also removes the Ethernet controller. So no Ethernet on here. It's most of the power of the 3 B Plus, but smaller. And it's going to fit in more places, more projects. Makers are really going to know exactly what to use it for. It also carries another point of significance. And this is important to remember. It's basically the last of the classic Pis, meaning the next wave of upgrades will all be built with new underpinnings, which personally has me eagerly awaiting the next generation of Raspberry Pis. I think the next big upgrade is expected sometime next year in 2019, and that's when I'll be able to take my my MAME cabinet at home and make it even a little bit more powerful, as if I need to. But technology, if the upgrade is there, you're going to take it, right?
Mm-hmm. I want to buy 20 of these just because the ad is so wonderful. It feels like it's a joke, but it's something like we would actually do.
I didn't watch the ad.
Oh, it's so good. I saw they were showing it earlier on Patrick's show on Twitch. And I was looking up and I was like, what is that 80s like computer commercial? And it's their ad, which is really funny. You got to watch it.
Okay, I will.
Josh just showed it, so I got to watch it while you were talking.
Yes, yes. I was distracted.
Yeah, I borrowed a Raspberry Pi from Leo to do some Raspberry Pi IoT stuff, and it's out of my desk, gave it back to him.
Yeah.
Raspberry Pis are not my thing. I respect that they are your thing and other people's thing. And I just said I would buy 10 of them, but I often buy things I don't use. So.
Yeah, if you buy 10 of them, can I have one?
Yes, yes.
Because I'll use it. I don't know what for, but...
Yes.
I mean, I'm not as makery as a lot of people out there as far as Raspberry Pis. My use for a Raspberry Pi is very specific. It's for emulation machines, but people have a lot of ideas around these things. And this one just basically takes all that power and shrinks it down to a smaller form factor. So that just means you can fit in a lot more places. Maybe you don't need a big USB hub with like four ports in it like the B Plus has. You only need one, and you save $10 in the process. This is going to be on sale in December. $25. These things are so cheap. It's crazy.
Oh, I thought it was $10. I don't know why I thought it was $10.
$25. No, it's $25 for this. Oh, they do have smaller, less feature filled versions.
The $10 one things. Has no Wi-Fi chip on it, right? So you can't
I can't remember exactly, but I know that I'm certain that they have those that are, less emphasis on the networking aspect.
And $25, that's pretty pricey for a computer.
I know. Tell me about it. Who's paying $25 these days for a computer? The B Plus, the 3 B Plus costs $35. That's kind of the top of the line that you can get right now. And so their top of the line computer, $35. And I'm really looking forward to the big upgrade, though.
Right. And so it's nice that it has Wi-Fi because you don't need all the ports. Like you could use a wireless mouse or a wireless keyboard to do your... Raspberry Pi stuff that you do.
Whatever it is you guys do with your Raspberry Pis and stuff. Exactly. If you even need those, because a lot of times these aren't used as computers. They're used to drive something else, mm-hmm. So anyways, if you're a maker, I'm sure this news made you happy. Tech News Weekly records live every Thursday at 2:30 p.m. Pacific at twit.tv/live. You can be part of the show by emailing us at tnw@twit.tv.
You can subscribe to our show at twit.tv/tnw. And if you want to tweet at me about things that I should try to make Vector do or questions that I should ask him, please tweet those at me. I'm at Megan Maroney.
And I'm at Jason Howell. Thanks to everyone who helped us with this show today. Burke, Jammer B, Alex, Josh, Colleen, and they worked their tails off to help us do today's show. And thanks to Vector for never shutting up throughout the course of this entire episode. We'll see y'all next week on another episode of Tech News Weekly. Bye, everybody. Fist bump.